nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to the 27th Hawkins Memorial Lecture. My name is Tim Fisher, and it is my privilege and honor to initiate today's proceedings. I'm going to tell you first a little bit about this event. The Hawkins Memorial Lecture was established in 1984 to honor the many contributions of Professor George A. Hawkins to both Purdue and to the broader academic and industrial and engineering communities. Professor Hawkins, former dean of engineering here at Purdue, and is renowned for his many contributions as a teacher, a researcher, and administrator. He retained a strong commitment to heat transfer throughout his career. He was really instrumental in bringing heat transfer from a science into engineering, along with several others around the country back in the middle of the last century. He's received many honors, including membership in the National Academy of Engineering. And as dean, he did a lot of work in engineering education, having served also as national president of the American Society for Engineering Education in 1970. This lecture provides an opportunity for a leader in the field to tell us about present topics in heat transfer, but in a context of relevance to the broader university community. The series is supported by an endowment created with gifts contributed by members of the heat transfer faculty in mechanical engineering. Much like Professor Hawkins, this year's speaker, Dr. Arun Majumdar, has had a profound impact on heat transfer and engineering generally, and he continues in the rich tradition of eminent speakers who have stood on this podium through the series past. Dr. Majumdar received his bachelor degree from IIT Bombay. He then received a PhD from UC Berkeley, working in the lab of CLTN. From there, he spent time at various universities, the majority of which he spent at UC Berkeley, serving as the Maynard Chair Professorship in their mechanical engineering department. A little bit later, he became Associate Laboratory Director at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, and in October of 2009, President Obama appointed him the first director of the of ARPA-E, the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy, where he continues to serve. Throughout his career, he has been an inspiration to those in heat transfer and spanning across many different disciplines now with leading a new initiative in Washington. He has had an amazing career. We are very fortunate to have him here today. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Arun Majumdar.
Well, thank you very much, Tim. It's just delightful to be here. Now that I've sort of left academia and I'm in Washington, D.C., any opportunity I get to get out of Washington, I take it up. So thank you very much for getting me out of there. It's great to be on a campus with amongst young people out here that I see. When I look at the list of the previous speakers of this lecture, I'm just absolutely amazed and honored to be on this list, starting with Professor Eckert, Professor Tien, Professor Burgles, etc. And to be in that company is a tremendous, tremendous honor for me. What I'm going to talk about, I realize that I'm giving three lectures in less than 24 hours, so I have to sort of differentiate a little bit. My hardcore heat transfer lecture, it's going to be tomorrow. What I thought I'll do out here is to give a broad overview of the energy landscape and where our country is today in a sort of historical viewpoint and what we need to do moving forward. So part of it is going to be a little bit of bad news I should share with you, a little warning. But there's some good news as well. And I try to make the bad news in as amusing a way, but there's some wake-up calls that we're seeing that ought to be taken very seriously. So I'll get back to ARPA-E, which is supposed to be the DARPA for energy. And there are similarities, but there are some fundamental differences that I think that needs to happen in ARPA-E that's different from DARPA. And I'll come back to that later on. But let me talk about where we are today and where is the world going in energy. And so I'll start with the population density of the world. And we are somewhere out here, and you can see the population density, on the eastern side, on the western side, sparse out here. And this is the global population density. Darker the colors, the higher the population density. You can see the density in Europe, in parts of Africa, pockets of Africa and South America. But there's no question that the big population density today, the highest population, India, China, Japan, Indonesia, etc. What is happening is that if you look at where the population is going, today we are about 6.5 billion people, and it's going to go to about 12 billion people by the end of the century. And 99% of the growth is going to happen in the developing economies, 99%. And the rest of the countries, like United States and others, will add to about 1%. So it's very important to keep that perspective, because when you're talking about an energy issue, it is a global issue. And yes, we have our own challenges internally within the United States, and I'll come to that, but one should not take that eye off that ball, that it is a global issue. So this is the population density. The lighting is not that great in the room. The lighting out there shows where the energy is being used. And you can see United States. You can actually point out the cities, the eastern corridor out here, the western cities, Los Angeles, San Diego. And you can actually see the Nile. You can see Japan, Europe, etc. What I'm going to do is to overlay the population of the world and then this picture to see how they work out. Unfortunately, the pictures are not that great on this screen. But what is clear then, that the population and energy use do not correlate. And you find that you can barely see the redness of the population density out here, a lot of bright lights. And here, you find that there are really highly population dense countries that have not yet turned on the lights. And if they turn on the lights the way we have done in the West, it's going to be a problem. So the big challenge for our generation and several other generations for this century, frankly, is how do we enable people out here to turn on the lights, the right kind of lights, and so that they, as their income grows, they can use the energy, they need the energy, but also keep our lights on and maybe make them brighter without additional energy use. And so the question is, that's the big challenge. And it's a non-trivial challenge because it has to do with economics, it has to do with policy, it has to do with education, not just technology. And if one can align all four of them, we have a way moving forward. Today, they're not aligned. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about where we are. And while this is a big challenge, here's a huge opportunity. This is carbon emission per capita in tons of CO2 per year. And this is GDP per capita, which correlates to income level. So this red dashed line is the global average, which is about 5 tons of CO2 per year. And if you multiply by the population of 6.5 billion people, that's about 30 to 32 tons of CO2, gigatons of CO2 per year. That's the total output of the world. But per capita, United States is way up here. We are the number one. We are competing with Australia out here. And you can see some kind of a correlation. France sort of goes horizontally because they went nuclear in the 70s and 80s. And you find that India, China, Brazil, Mexico, which are some of the, and Malaysia out here, with developing economies, per capita, of course, they look good. But if you aggregate it, they are, China is higher than the United States today. Nevertheless, if you take per capita, they are going to move. The question is, which direction do they move? So if you look at this and say, what path does each country take? And for the United States, I hope there's only one direction this will move, and that is this way. Because I think the other way is the wrong direction for the United States. The question is, what about these countries out here? And if business as usual, this would be the path. This is business as usual, as the other countries have followed in the past. And many of these countries have realized that that is not the way to go. And that is not the future for the economy, for their population, for their environment, etc. And many of these countries are now, without any Copenhagen or Kyoto, they've realized for their own prosperity that it is possibly this path to go. And this transition in the economies of these countries it's going to take time, and it's not going to be that easy. But China, for example, is investing heavily in deploying clean energy technologies so that they go along this path. This difference between the former path, the business as usual, and the possible path in the future, and this direction for the United States is an opportunity. It's frankly a business opportunity. So these two are business opportunities, and people who have realized, large multinationals like GE and all have realized this, and they are transitioning themselves to avail of this opportunity. So the question is, what needs to be done, and are we ready as a nation to avail of this opportunity? So let's see where we are. So this is a wake-up call. There are several wake-up calls. This is one. This is the lithium-ion battery manufacturing volume in 2009. And this is before the Recovery Act investment. And the United States had less than 1%. 1% is a little forgiving out here. It's less than 1% of the manufacturing volume of lithium-ion batteries, which will obviously go into plug-in hybrids, etc. And in the same year, the Department of Energy gave the highest award, the Fermi Award, to John Goodenough for inventing the cathode of the lithium-ion battery. And this is ironic, the contrast out here, that he invented this in the 80s, and now all of that is over there. And this is a wake-up call. And while it is this is a global market, it is very difficult to have 100% of the manufacturing volume, but less than 1% is staggering. There are many other examples. We have less than 10% of the manufacturing volume of solar photovoltaic cells. And so if you are to avail that opportunity, we're not quite there yet. And the Recovery Act has made the investment in lithium-ion batteries, and that'll go up to, once it fully gets deployed, it'll go up to about 20% or so. But that's still not good enough. And the question is, are there other opportunities in R&D that we should be looking at? And I'll come back to that later on. This is a wake-up call. And I was involved in this with Secretary Chu's science team to stop the BP oil spill, made several trips to Houston to understand and really use our engineering skills to see how to analyze this two-phase flow and stop it. And when you go through these process, I didn't realize what I was getting into, and none of us realized what we were getting into, but many of us lost many hours of sleep on this one. Because right now it looks good, but when we were going through it, it could have gone many different ways. And there was not enough data, and we were in a total data-free zone. Just to give you an example, the blowout preventer that was there, the two-story tall, $20 million thing, do you know how many pressure gauges that were there in that to measure the pressure and estimate the flow rate? There was one. And that also, it was not working. So it was a huge data-free zone, and if someone says that, no, it'll take a long time to improve these things, I think there's room for improvement in putting a few more pressure gauges in these kinds of things. But the risk involved in deep water drilling and exploration is certainly there, and we need to be aware of it and use this opportunity to change the ball game in that and become as safe as the nuclear industry is today. But we also, this is also true that we import 60% of our oil, and for countries that don't often like us. And the question is, this is an issue really at the national security level. It is our economic security for sure. There's a lot of money going out of the country. And certainly, as we now see, it's part of our environmental security as well. So this is the DNA of our nation. And we got to get this right. And energy innovation, I'll show, is at the core of this. So this is, and this, if there's any prosperity of, if you have to think about the prosperity of our country, we need to solve this problem. So ARPA-E came out of a report. It was proposed for the first time in a report called Rising Above the Gathering Storm, the National Academy's report, which was chaired by Norm Augustine, who was the former chairman and CEO of Lockheed Martin, and sort of who's who of the cream of the intellectual cream of this country were there in this, including Secretary Chu. And they proposed an organization like DARPA, called ARPA-E, at least using the operational model from DARPA, which was authorized in America Competes Act in 07, in the previous administration, and then funded for the, launched by the Recovery Act by President Obama last year. So we are 1 year old, and I'll give you a report of that 1 year pretty soon. So what was written in that report? And let me just give you one excerpt. It's a big, thick report. There was a lot of issues on STEM education, K through 12 education, and there were many pages on that. But let me pick out one thing that is striking. This Gathering Storm Committee concluded that the primary driver of the future economy and concomitant creation of jobs will be innovation, largely from advances in science and engineering. And this statement is quite interesting. While only 4% of the nation's workforce is composed of scientists and engineers, this group disproportionately creates jobs for the other 96%. So you scientists and engineers out there, there's a duty out here to really look after the health and the prosperity, economic prosperity of this nation through science and engineering innovation. Well, that was 2006, and it was written up in 2005. It came out in 2006. This same group met again, and this was a review of that report and see what has happened. And this was called Rising Above the Gathering Storm Revisited, and they felt that the storm is rapidly approaching Category 5 right now. And this was released a couple of weeks ago. There was a hearing in the House Science Committee, Norm Augustine and others, who reported. And I want to show you some excerpts of that as to what does the committee think today as opposed to 5 years ago. So let's go to, and this is the amusing part of it. This is, it was felt, the unanimous view of the committee members, our nation's outlook has worsened. And while progress is made in creating, in certain areas, and we got highlighted, the latitude to fix problems being confronted has been severely diminished, primarily because of the debt. The national debt has gone from $8 to $13 trillion. And finally, I won't read through everything. It was also said that many other nations have been markedly progressing towards where we want to progress, and that has reduced America's relative ability to compete for various things, new factories, jobs, etc. And while we should encourage other nations to make progress as fast as possible, we should be doing that too. And that was one statement. The other one was, again, coming back, the only promising avenue for achieving this latter outcome in the view of this Gathering Storm Committee is through innovation. And fortunately, this nation has in the past demonstrated considerable prowess in this regard. So going back to this is a wake-up call, guys. We need to wake up because we have the ability. We just haven't focused on energy as we have on other things like information technology, etc. I just want to throw out some factoids, which is rather amusing, but it's also scary. Among the manufacturers of photovoltaics, wind turbines, and advanced batteries, the top 10 global firms by market cap include 2, 1, and 1 U.S. firms respectively. Two in photovoltaics, 1 in wind turbine, 1 in batteries. The other firms belong to all these nations out here. A Japanese company produces over 75% of the world's nickel metal hydride batteries, which go into all the hybrid electric vehicles. And this one is amusing. U.S. spends more on potato chips than energy R&D, and more on dog food R&D than R&D in the electrical power sector. Okay? We got it backwards, guys. So here's a few quotes. This is from Tom Friedman. In today's integrated digitized global market, where knowledge and innovation tools are so widely distributed, whatever can be done will be done. The only question is, will it be done by you or to you? And the other one is actually quite interesting as well. The greatest long-term threat to U.S. national security is not terrorists wielding a nuclear biological weapon, but the erosion of America's place as a world leader in science and technology. This is coming from the Department of Defense. So This is the state we are in. It's a little bit of a bad news, but the good news is that we still have the best science and engineering infrastructure out here in the universities such as this. I'd like to use the next quote as a wake-up call. Gentlemen, we have run out of money. It's time to start thinking. Right? And we got to use it. This is what we have, and we got to start using it. So this is where we are. We need to avail of the opportunity. We have the ability to do so. The question is, what do we need to do? It's going back to the basics. So has the world, looking at the transition of the economies and the challenges to humanity, I would say, in keeping the economy going and providing the energy for this growing population, has the world faced such a challenge before? Because we are in this coming century, it's going to be a huge challenge. We are resource limited, and we are geographically limited as well. And the question is, what do we need to do? Have we faced this before? And the answer is yes. Let me give you a few examples. And science and engineering came to the rescue out here. Go back to 1898, when there was a calling upon science to save the world from impending starvation. This is Sir William Crookes, who was a physicist, the president of the British Association of the Advancement of Science. And he did some calculations saying that we are in trouble. Why? Because the soil in Europe and other places did not have enough nutrition to feed the people. And the population was starting to grow because the water quality, etc., improved. So people started living longer. And the population started increasing. And there was not enough food. And the only nutrition that one could get, natural nutrition, was found in South America. And that was these guano islands in South America. Guano is essentially bird poop. And bird poop has a lot of nutrition, nitrates and phosphates, etc. So there was a mad rush to go to South America, these islands, these heaps of bird poop essentially. They were basically digging and taking it all the way back to Europe and to the United States. By the way, this fed all the American soldiers in the Civil War, as well as created bombs, explosives, because of the nitrates they used for explosives as well. So this happened for a while, and they ran out of guano. And fortunately, just a coincidence, they found in Chile something called saltpeter, which is natural nitrate crystals, which they went after that. And there were wars between Peru, Bolivia, Chile, and there were battleships going from Europe to get those resources and helping these other countries. Sounds familiar? That's what happened. But what Crookes found out was, did some calculations that even if you take all the saltpeter and the guano was already over by then, even you take all that, it's not enough capacity to feed the world. So something else needs to be done. And he appealed to the chemists, saying that figure out a way to make nitrates or basically fix nitrogen. And in 10 years, Fritz Haber, who's a chemist, developed a catalyst that would combine atmospheric nitrogen with hydrogen to form ammonia. That catalyst, the first catalyst, was uranium. This is pre-nuclear. And then also found osmium, which was also expensive. And then the whole discovery, catalyst discovery, talking about catalyst in Purdue University, there was a whole catalyst discovery phase of trying to find cheaper catalyst. But this was the science. Then there was an engineer, a chemical engineer, Karl Bosch at BASF, who developed a process to mass produce ammonia and make fertilizers. And this mass production produced new chemistries. This is high pressure chemistry. And there were two sets of Nobel Prizes that were given. One to Haber, then to Bosch. And there's a beautiful book called The Alchemy of Air. If you ever get a chance, read it. This is science and engineering, and in the political environment of that time, which was World War I and World War II, and how it impacted everything, how it impacted business. And Bosch turned out to be one of the best businessmen of his age. But nevertheless, this was considered to be one of the most important, if not the most important innovation of the 20th century, of the whole century. Why? Because it affected humanity like none other, and the world population went out here, 1900, somewhere out here. This was the slope. It changed the slope. And most of us would not be here if it was not for this innovation. So this was a game changer, and it went back to science and engineering, coming out in a different way. Other game changes. This is in a green revolution, dwarf strain of wheat, land use became like this. People were predicting population bomb and Malthusian economics would work and all that. That went completely upside down with this innovation out here, and the grain production and land use went in different direction, and you got the Nobel Peace Prize. And I would not be here if it was not for this green revolution. There are other innovations like this, polio vaccination, Salk and many others after him, and changed the ballgame completely. It's a nonlinear effect. So if you are in that moment in history again, that things don't look good, we are resource limited, there are other geopolitical issues, we need to go back to science and engineering to come out in a different way. And the question is, if there is a pace and scale of innovation that we need, what is it today? And if necessity is the mother of all invention, this is the mother of all necessities, the energy and the climate issue. So here's a pace and scale of innovation. This is my opinion. If you look at all the game changes of the 20th century, artificial fertilizer, green revolution, polio vaccination, all the way down to airplanes, electrification, nuclear energy, down to internet. And most of the kids know this, but they really are not aware of the others. If you look at this 100 years of major changes and imagine that happening in the next 20 years, that is the scale and the pace that we need. That means this next 20 years has to be the most inventive time period of our history to address that mother of all necessities. And I thought I was the only one saying it. This was my opinion. Bill Gates said exactly the same thing. And when Bill Gates says it, everyone listens. And so this is great. So the question is, what is that list of the future? And as a great American philosopher, Yogi Berra, says, it's very hard to predict, especially the future. So the question is, what is it? So here are some guesses. And as I will point out, the technology in the case of the Haber-Bosch process is not just technology, but economics has to play a role because it has to be market compatible. And many other Nobel laureates were in that race to produce fixed nitrogen. They won because it was economically viable. So what is that list? Here are some thoughts. Solar electricity generation at a cost lower than that produced from fossil fuels. What is the price? $1 a watt fully installed solar. Today it's about $3 to $4 in the case of utility scale. It's about $8 to $10 for residential. We got to cut that by a factor of 5 to 8 or so. And that is not trivial. So the technology, the science of the technology should be directed to reduce the cost so that it scales without subsidies. And that would be then scalable, enable business. Real-time optimization, security storage for the grid for two-way dispatchable electric power. And power in this case is really important. And can we get the grid to be digital? Can we get it like the internet? Can you actually dispatch batches, groups and then enable distributed generation? That does not happen today. Carbon capture and utilization, the use of carbon dioxide at a net cost that is lower than its market price so that you actually enable business. Car batteries, which are 3 times energy density, 4 times lower cost, and I'll come to that later on. Transportation fuels from sunlight. At the end of the day, it's nuclear and sunlight. And can you produce fuels for transportation at a cost lower than that of petroleum? 50 to 80% reduction in energy consumption in buildings. And this is really hard challenge. On the demand side, there's the market inefficiencies that we have to consider. Low-cost desalination of water. Low-cost and safe nuclear energy. And so you can go on, and everyone will have different lists, and I think we should all put that together and see where we come out. And I think National Academy has had a list of this. I think solar came out as number one. But the economics of solar is really critical. So what do we do? ARPA-E was sort of created in this environment, when this august group of people felt that if this is the game-changing, events or technology that we need, the current structure is not really geared up for that. We need a DARPA high risk, people or agency which is willing to take risks, and failure is okay. And that's a different kind of environment that was there in 2006. So what's the mission? It's a mission-oriented agency just like DARPA. The mission is to overcome long-term and high-risk technological barriers in the development of energy technologies, and 2 mission statements. One, to enhance the energy and economic security of the United States, the development of technologies, energy technologies. 2, reduce imports of energy from foreign sources, reduction of energy-related emissions, including greenhouse gases, and to improve the energy efficiency of all economic sectors. That's number one, is the economic and energy security. And the other one is to ensure that the United States maintains a technological lead in developing and deploying advanced energy technologies. This one is similar to DARPA, because if you go back in the history of DARPA, it got created in 1958 in response to the launch of Sputnik, when it was felt that the U.S. was losing its technological lead to the Soviets. And then DARPA got created. NASA came out of that, or of that whole time frame, and to advance space as well as information technology and defense technology. This is the time for RP. So can we create and ensure technology, technological lead? Can we create technologies that will ensure the lead for the United States? So I'll show you some examples of that now. A little bit of history. Where do we start? what do we do? So this is the supply-demand curve, and some of you may have seen this. This is called the Sankey diagram, or colloquially called the spaghetti chart for United States energy. Here's the supply side. This is a few years old. Here's supply side, and here's the demand side. This is where the energy comes from, and this is called primary energy. Petroleum is about 40%. These are quads. So total energy on the supply side is about 100 quadrillion BTUs, 100 quads. So these numbers are almost percentages, 40%. 24, so 60% of that is imports, other 40% is domestic, natural gas, coal, nuclear, solar, etc. If you look at the number, solar is 0.006. And these, by the way, these lines, the thickness of these lines are to show the magnitude. I don't think there's a font size which can show 0.006. But that's where we were a few years ago, comparatively much, much smaller. And here is the demand side. Where does the energy go? So this is the buildings, residential and commercial buildings, which takes about 40% of our energy, 75% of our electricity, so the grid is there for the buildings. Industrial, which is petrochemicals, cement, steel, glass, paper, that's what consumes energy. And these are transportation. So as you can see, petroleum mostly goes to transportation out here. So if you ask the question, what do we need to do? Well, we certainly need to decarbonize this side. Reduce the imports to zero, if you can. Decarbonize this. Amplify nuclear. Amplify all this. Reduce the demand and have a smart infrastructure in between. That's it. But of course, it's easier said than done, because it has to be done in an economic way. Because we already have electricity at, I don't know what the Indiana price is, but it's about 10 cents a kilowatt hour. We already have that. We have heat. We have natural gas. So the incumbency of these systems, so someone has to make it cheaper to do it a different way. And that needs some policy help. That needs people to be aware. And, you know, that needs new kinds of financing. So the financial markets, the policy world, education, and technology, science and technology, all have to be aligned. And right now it's not quite aligned together. So we're trying to get, RPE's mission is technology. That's what we're focusing on. And we're trying to push other people to look at the other sides of it. So RPE, when it started, and this was before my time, before I joined there, this was Secretary Chu basically handling everything, and said, let's just open it up. Open up the gates and see what comes in. And people thought that, you know, we'll get about 400, 500 proposals. Almost 4,000 came in, because there was so much pent-up demand in new energy technology funding. Not science, but technology funding. And so I'll show you some ideas that are disruptive in many ways that I'm going to talk about today in the first round of funding. Here's an idea. I like this very much because I can explain it in a way that I think people who are non-technical can understand. Let me explain this. Biofuels, cellulosic biofuels, is a lot of people feel that that's the way to go. Take agricultural waste and make fuels out of it. And the way it is done is that, you know, in agriculture waste, there's something called lignin, which goes around cellulose, and they have to be separated out. So let's say you get switchgrass or something. You've got to separate out the cellulose. So now once you've got cellulose, which is a long-chain polymer, you've got to break it up and the way into small sugar molecules. And the way it is broken is to throw a whole cocktail of enzymes. And cows have them in their guts. Termites have them that can break down cellulose. And these are endonucleases, exonucleases, a whole cocktail of them. And then once they're broken up into small sugar molecules, you feed them into other microbes like programmed E. coli bugs, and then you can get all kinds of, you know, long-chain hydrocarbons or alcohols. The biggest expense is the cellulose, the enzymes that break down cellulose. You got to make them separately in bioreactors, etc., and that's a huge cost. But that's the way it is going. So this small company, startup company of two people, came up with this idea, which I thought was intriguing. He said, we know what those enzymes are. We know what those gene sequences of those enzymes are. Why not put the genes in the plant itself? So when the plant is growing, it's actually producing these enzymes at the same time, free of cost. But then the question is, okay, will the plant survive when it's producing its own enzymes to break it down? What they did, a trick that they used for the medicine, for the medical area, is to take these enzymes while it's producing, is to put a blocker in between. So these enzymes are inactive while it's being produced. And so this plant is growing, it's producing its own enzyme, it's inactive, so nothing happens to the plant. Till you say that, okay, now it is ready to be harvested and you want biofuels out of it, you give it a trigger from the outside, like change the temperature a little bit or change the pH, and these enzymes get activated and it then chews itself from the inside, free of cost. So this is what they're trying. And I find it fascinating. I call it explaining it to Congress, for example, is to putting the cow inside the plant. It's breaking down or whatever's there in the cow's guts is putting inside the plant itself. If this succeeds, then it could challenge today's approach of biofuels and make it disruptive, and that could be a competitive thing. So this is an internal competition within the United States that we're creating. Another example, grid-level storage. For the grid, any smart grid, the storage is the biggest issue. The problem is that how do you store gigawatts of electricity for about an hour or so? It's not easy. Okay, today's lithium-ion batteries are about, the laptop batteries are $2,000 a kilowatt hour, and lithium-ion car batteries are about $1,000 a kilowatt hour. And that is just not economic. I mean, it'll add a huge amount of cost to the electricity that we buy. It has to be less than $100 a kilowatt hour, because the additional cost of electricity is about 2 cents then. And so this is an innovation that came out of the material science department at MIT, Don Sadoway, where they took aluminum manufacturing. And the way aluminum is manufactured is you take molten salt, you take salt, aluminum salt, heat it up, melt it, pass electricity through it, you know, hundreds of thousands of amps, and plate out aluminum on one side. And it's a other electrode, you have a gas reaction, and it just goes away. What they were able to do is to take a metal solution and then plate out both electrodes and thereby store the charge. And when you allow them to mix, you get charge out. And they feel that they can get it down to about $50 a kilowatt hour, which, even if they're double of that, $100 is good enough. Beautiful, innovation in wind turbines. Today's wind turbines are three-blade rotors. And what you find, I mean, if the fluid mechanics tells us, there's something called a Betz limit. That is, the streamlines, when they come, they have to spread out to conserve energy, conserve mass and momentum. And you can only get about 60% of the energy from today's wind turbines. Well, if you look at a gas or a jet engine, it's not quite a propeller. You can entrain the flow if you know the fluid mechanics. And this is what they've done out here. They've used some very nifty vortex dynamics downstream to be able to entrain flow and actually beat the Betz limit, reduce the cost, reduce the size, increase the reliability, reduce the cost by 40%. And so this is a startup company that is in the Boston area. So these are some examples of how challenging today's approaches by totally new ways of doing things is sort of the way that ARPA-E was born. This is before my time. So what is an ARPA-E project? Certainly it has to be high impact on the mission areas of ARPA-E. New technologies, devices, and prototype systems that do not exist in today's energy market. So if it is already there in the energy market, any improvement will be incremental, and there are other places in DOE that can do that. But things that do not exist today, that's what we'll focus on. Too risky for the private sector investment. And private sector, they will not take certain technology risks, will certainly not take market risk. And if successful, these technologies, success could make today's technologies obsolete, could have large commercial impact, and could produce new learning curves and new markets. That's the kind of feature that we're looking for in projects. And strong impact on ARPA-E funding relative to the private sector. That means if we ask the question, if it is successful, will the private sector, whether it's venture investment or large companies, will they pick it up? So that's our exit strategy. And finally, the best-in-class peoples and team of scientists and engineers and attracting the U.S. intellectual horsepower. So let me just say a little bit. This is to really bring scientists and engineers together in a team. So there's a feedback loop between what science could possibly do that engineers have to understand and engineering system specs that the scientists have to understand. And that, in a collection together, the feedback loop and the information transfer needs to happen in real time. That's what speed is. And really getting people from other disciplines, whether it's the best computer scientist or best biologist looking at medical area, getting them into energy R&D. Because this is the time to attract the best minds into this field. That's what we're looking for in our big projects. So just to give you a few examples of new programs that we have created. This is called the BEAST program. We have an acronym for a few things. Batteries for electrical energy storage for transportation. Let me tell you what was the philosophy behind doing it. This is the energy density of batteries. This is in watt hour per kilogram. This is today's lithium-ion battery. The theoretical limit of today's lithium-ion battery is about 365 watt hour per kilogram. And this is the effective practical value for engines, or internal combustion engines. So the energy density of a gasoline is about 12,000 watt hour per kilogram. You bring in the efficiency of the engine, it comes to around 3,000 to 4,000 watt hour per kilogram. That's lithium-ion batteries. There are other batteries, which are zinc air, lithium sulfur, lithium air. Some of these have higher effective energy densities. And we had not been funding because it's too risky. It's going to fail. And the Japanese government was investing $60 million a year. We don't even know what the private sector is investing. So we decided to look into this area and also to create these kinds of batteries, also to create new manufacturing processes, because today's batteries have been made the same way as several decades ago. And these are made into 18650 cells. And in a Tesla car, there are about 6,000 of them together. There may be better ways to do economies of scale when you want to make a large battery as opposed to making, you know, 18650 cells. So we said we'll create a program, we'll give targets, and this is out of a workshop. 400 watt hour per kilogram, which is about 2.5 times, and $250 a kilowatt hour, which is 4 times lower than today. So the multiplier in cost performance is 10x. And if you've read Andy Grove's book on Only the Paranoid Survive, you'll find that a 10x factor can change the ball game. And so that was the idea. And we said, we don't care it is, you know, whether it is zinc or magnesium or unobtainium. As long as it can meet these specs, we are okay. And new manufacturing techniques. And out of that came some very interesting ideas. Magnesium ion, new kinds of flow batteries using lithium ion, zinc air, lithium sulfur, lithium air, two different approaches to lithium air batteries, new manufacturing techniques, applied materials, A123 got together and do large-scale battery manufacturing, which, and they'll be competing with Planar Devices to do large-scale manufacturing as well. Low-cost carbon capture. Today's ways of carbon capture is using amines. You take amines, expose it to carbon dioxide, you get carbon-made bonds, you take them aside, heat them, break the bonds, and get pure CO2 or concentrated CO2. That heating, the heat transfer part of it, takes energy. And that makes the cost of carbon capture to about $80 a ton of CO2. And the market price, at least in Europe, we don't have a price in the United States, but in Europe, is $30 a ton of CO2. So if someone wants to start a business in carbon capture, they will start with a loss of around $50 to $60 a ton. It's a non-starter. So the question is, can we bring down the cost of carbon capture at a faster pace than what the amines are doing? The amine has a learning curve. Can we create new learning curves? And this needs, you know, technological innovations. So this is one example of an aqueous solution of a reagent where you pass CO2 through it and you get the carbon dioxide bonded to something that you can separate out as a solid and the water remains out there. So when you heat it, you don't have to heat up the water. And as we know, water has one of the highest heat capacities, if not the highest heat capacity. And so you only have to heat this, and the potential cost comes down to about $25 to $30 a ton. And this estimate is actually, if it was coming from an academic institution, one would say, you know, we need to get some business guys to really understand that. This is coming from GE, who really know how to scale stuff. So that's a completely different way, and there are many other ideas. I'm just giving you one example of what is possible. This is a totally different way of doing synthetic fuels. It's called the Electrofuels Program. And we coined this word because it's so different. The idea is the following. All biofuels today follows the photosynthetic route. It's photosystem 1 and 2. You take, take sunlight, use that energy to fix carbon dioxide through something called the Calvin-Benson cycle. And whether it is plants, biomass, or algae, whatever, it's all using the cycle, and that is less than 1% efficient from photons to chemical bonds. It's less than 1% efficient. There are other ways in systems which are other than the Calvin cycle, where are microbes which can fix carbon dioxide, where the efficiency is up to 90%, and they haven't even been touched. And the energy need not come from sunlight. Energy can come from other sources. Here's the idea. Energy can come from hydrogen sulfide, which is a waste product in oil and natural gas, and hydrogen, ammonia, direct current, maybe from nuclear energy, direct current, or from oxidation of ion species or other oxidation states of different elements. And then you can generalize this idea of not only just Calvin-Benson cycle, this is reverse Krebs cycle, other cycles that are there that have not been used for fuel synthesis. And there are multiple microbes which use these mechanisms to fix carbon dioxide. And then, of course, generate fuels. So this is a generalization of biofuels in things that are not photosynthetic and increase the efficiency. So the idea is basically to explore this. This opens up the ball game and provides alternate routes. Other programs, very simply, is this is grid-level storage at a cost lower than $100 a kilowatt hour. I'm going to talk about this. This is air conditioning, which, has been around for a while, but I'm going to talk about this in a few minutes. Since it's a Hawkins lecture, I have to talk about something thermal, and I'm going to talk about this. This one, power electronics. This is a new program, power electronics. Power electronics, if you look at around electrical engineering departments around the country and ask how many people are actually doing power, the very, very few. Either they've retired or there's not enough critical mass in many of the universities. And we buy all our transformers from China and most of our other components from Germany and Japan. And this is total white space. And so we decided to open up this program where we are seeing innovations in looking at wide bandgap semiconductors, gallium nitride on silicon, silicon carbide, and making switches out of that, integrating with magnetics on the same chip and capacitors to really make devices that can do DC to DC, DC to AC, AC to AC conversion. And one of these innovation, actually, if this works, this will reduce the size of a transformer for a substation, which is at about 13 to 20 kilovolts, from about 10,000 pounds, which is there today, that is, you need a crane to actually install it, to about 100 pounds. And that's the kind of innovation, if it really happens, it's dropping 20 kilovolts across a single layer of silicon carbide. And so that's a program that goes all the way from computers and power supplies all the way to substation, including power converters for hybrid vehicles, for solar farms, etc. Let me talk about cooling. So those of you who've been in the thermodynamics and cooling field, this is the psychrometric chart, as you all know. Temperature out here, humidity ratio out here. And most of the time, we have to go from a state which is high temperature and high humidity, like in Washington in summer, and perhaps out here as well, to a supply air in a building which is about 55 degrees Fahrenheit and 40% humidity. And the question is, how do we get there? And one way to do this is 100% relative humidity. One way to do that is to cool it, extract the humidity out, cool it all the way, and then reheat it. Okay, so this is total waste of energy in many ways because you got to cool it down to really low temperatures. This is one way. The other way is to do it go this way. That is, you take the humidity and you absorb the moisture into a desiccant, and the enthalpy is given out, the temperature rises, then it goes out here, and then you got to refrigerate it. And you can do a little bit of regenerative heat exchange out there, but you still got to cool it the heck out of it from here to there. The challenge has been, can we go vertical? Can we do isothermal humidity exchange and then go this way, because the energy required for that will be much less? There's a lot of work which has been done in this. In fact, if we looked at the history of this, some of the first absorption chillers were the patents belonged to Einstein and Leo Szilard. They were working on this in the early 20th century. So what is the thermodynamic limit of this? Because now you have a desiccant, you have a mechanical work in a compressor. If you look at this, if you have the indoor environment at a certain temperature and humidity, and you've got an ambient at a certain temperature and humidity as well, there are, of course, two loads. One is the latent heat load, and the other is the sensible heat load. If you look at what is the thermodynamic limit, this is the free energy of mixing. Okay, the free energy of mixing is to really separate out the moisture from dry air. Okay, and that's, and this is, of course, the Carnot in the minimum work required if it's a purely thermodynamic, at the thermodynamic limit. So you can do latent heat, you can do COPs out here. But at the end of the day, you're looking at what is the primary energy that you use, which is, there are two sources. One is for moisture, the latent heat part, which you have to supply to a desiccant, and to a sensible heat part that comes from a power plant and work and goes into a reversible engine out here. So this is, so if you ask the question, can we plot primary energy, okay, the minimum primary energy that you need, and this is the plot that we came up with. This is minimum primary energy in kilojoules per kilogram of air, and this is COP of the vapor compression. And I said, where are we today? Well, this is the vapor compression line out here. This is the, as you increase the COP, the primary energy use goes down. This is the desiccant plus vapor compression out here. And we find most of the current system, whether it's rooftop air conditioners and all, are over here. And this is at about 120 kilojoules per kilogram, whereas the theoretical limit is about 12. So a factor of 10 away. And the question is, can we put a target out here? And I said, we don't care whether you make a different compressor. It's not about different, better compressor or better desiccant. I said, let's put the target and you innovate. Now, there are air conditioners which are, have a COP of 6 or 7, but they use water cooling and there's a loss of water. So I said, could you get this performance without loss of water? And what came out was quite fascinating. This is the other aspect of refrigeration, which we got aware last year, is this paper in PNAS that came out. We're looking at the greenhouse warming potential, the global warming potential of refrigerants, HFCs. And HFC has a potential of about 2,000 to 3,000 more than carbon dioxide. And if the economies in the developing countries are growing, you would find that the greenhouse effect of these refrigerants is about 20 to 25% of CO2. This is a big deal. So we said, can there be other refrigerants, whether it is a CO2, magnetocaloric? At the end of the day, it is an interplay between enthalpy and entropy. So are there other media out there, whether it's magnetocaloric, thermoacoustic, thermoelectric, and so on and so forth? And what came out, and I'll just give you a few examples. This is the one that is going vertically down. We have a membrane that is a small pore membrane. In this case, I believe it's a zeolite, where you've got oxygen, hydrogen, and nitrogen. And when you condense out here, the water blocks the oxygen and nitrogen, and you can evacuate and get the water out in an isothermal way. And thereby, it is different from a desiccant. And they claim they can potentially beat the target by 50%, we'll see. Here is a completely different cycle based on reverse osmosis. So using water as a refrigerant, and water is a great refrigerant, except that compression of water is very difficult. You need a really large compressor. They have turned this around by saying that, okay, let's take water vapor as a refrigerant, mix it with a salt like lithium bromide, and then use reverse osmosis to separate out the salt from pure water and put this cycle and then dump the heat in a evaporator out here. And they claim that they can beat the target by 50%. We'll see. These are ideas which are different. These are ideas that we don't know whether this is going to work, whether they'll beat it or not. At least on paper it shows they will come across some problems. Some of them will fail, but it's worth a shot. And so that's the kind of projects that we have funded. Very briefly, this is the org chart of Department of Energy. Here is the Office of Science under Steve Coonan. This is Christina Johnson, used to be there. Now she has left. It's Kathy Zoi out here, Undersecretary of Energy. We are over here reporting directly to the Secretary, but I coordinate very closely with the Undersecretaries out here. This is the team. It's very important when you start an agency that to put the right team. I'm really proud of who we have recruited, and these are term-limited people who have come from academia, from venture capital, who have some of the really bright people. Some of you may know Ravi Prasher, who left Intel and joined us. There's a commercialization team. It's really important that right from the beginning, and this is different from DARPA, I've been funded by DARPA for several years, decades. No one ever asked me how much it's going to cost. And we ask that question right from the beginning because we do not want to develop technologies that are not cost-effective down the line and scalable. So their role is to figure out how to get funding, the next round of funding from the private industry for the investment community, or how to take it to market. Operations team, outreach team, etc. We've created a fellows program because this is something that is really probably the most positive thing that has happened. Is we look around the universities, the students have figured out that this is probably the most important thing in their future. And they've broken down the boundaries between different disciplines and formed an energy club. And they want to change the world. Well, we said that let's get the best, the brightest of PhDs in science, engineering, or technical entrepreneurs and bring them into ARPA-E to form a think tank. Just like the Jasons are for DARPA, this will be for ARPA-E. And 80% of the work is to look at how to rewire that energy diagram, the spaghetti chart, and 20% of the work is to get the next generation involved in energy. We had an ARPA-E Energy Innovation Summit. I think some of you were there. A lot of energy. 1,700 people showed up. And this is really looking at all the communities together, scientists and engineers, entrepreneurs, other DOE offices, federal agencies, investors, and state and regional and international people as well. And we showcased not only the technologies that we funded, but also brought in the people that we could not fund. Because it'll take more than RPE to change the world. We said, let's just bring them on. And there were some deals, financial deals that were being made out there. We're going to repeat this. This is going to happen. This was announced yesterday in February 28 to March 2nd, 2011. We hope you can join us because I think this time around we'll do, I think it'll be even bigger. We have a lot more technologies to show. Let me just stop with a quote that was made at a different time, but I think it's really appropriate today. It's a quote by Martin Luther King. We are now faced with the fact, my friends, that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. And we hope we can change that through some of the things that we're doing today. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.